This is Second Look, a look back at some of the stories and conversations from our newsroom this week. I'm Bob Lebeke, WMRA's news director. Coming up later in this half hour, the next installment of our Clean Virginia series, plus some good news for Chesapeake Bay activists and the UVA Pluto mission connection, and an award-winning story from WMRA's Andrew Jenner. But first, the Red Wing Roots Music Festival will be wrapping up this evening at Natural Chimneys Park in Augusta County. Kara Lofton talked with band leader Trent Wagler earlier this week about the roots of the festival 3 years ago.
Sit me down, this old guitar, make it speak to me.
In the 5 years since they released their initial album called Red Wing, the Steel Wheels have traveled to festivals all over the United States, playing their soulful Americana music. Although being on the road can be brutally difficult at times, especially since it takes them away from their young families, it also gave the band an opportunity to develop a nuanced idea of what they liked about festivals and what they didn't like. For lead singer Trent Wagler,
that experience of being able to go to a community and really see the community through the eyes and experience of a music festival was really magical in certain situations. Where you see, initially you think of a festival as being one weekend out of the year, an event, and it is, but you, in certain times and situations, you see that one weekend out of the year and that event also just creates a larger and more continual kind of impact on a community.
And so an idea began to grow. What if they had their own festival here in the Shenandoah Valley, in the community that three out of the four bandmates call home? It took a while for the idea to develop from just a dream into a concrete plan. But within a year or two, several things came together at once. The Steel Wheels connected with producer Jeremiah Jenkins from Black Bear Productions. They found that Natural Chimneys Park already had an existing stage and great camping facilities, and they discovered that there were a number of local businesses willing to sponsor their endeavor. And so they launched the Red Wing Roots Festival, named after their first album, and people came.
What we really heard from the beginning from people was, please don't let this festival get too big. And that many people who go to music festivals, part of what they love about it is the relatability of it, the fact that they see their favorite artists or a new artist and don't just see them on stage, but see them walking from the stage to the merch tent, or see them in some smaller kind of showcase or workshop atmosphere and see them collaborate with some other artist, but really get to see them. And while there are festivals out there that have tens of thousands of people, and some people really like those huge groups, a lot of people in our, at least in our style of music, also really love that intimate festival that's big enough where you do have a large number and you can look around. I mean, 2,000 or 3,000 people feels like a large group to me, at least. But it's not so big that you get as overwhelmed as you do at a 20,000 or 30,000 person festival.
Wagler said even if they wanted to grow, they couldn't because they have already maxed out the space they have. That suits him just fine, though, because he is happy to grow the festival in other ways. That includes developing more of a jamming scene at the campgrounds and finding new ways to appeal more to teenagers.
In your first years, you're just trying to get it up on its feet. It's like you're just putting the tent up and hoping it's going to stay up in many ways. And now I think, over the years, we're trying to look at it a little closer and add nuance to the festival.
In addition to music from the Punch Brothers, Elephant Revival, and a little over 30 other bands, he said they are trying to add nuance to Red Wing by both providing an atmosphere for festival goers to listen to music and helping them take advantage of the natural resources at the park. Festival programming for this year includes 4 different guided bike rides, 2 hikes, and free yoga classes. It also means having a beer garden for adults, art activities for kids, and a plethora of local vendors. The idea is that anyone and everyone is welcome. For WMRA News, I'm Kara Lofton.
Spiderweb cracks and hard to tell.
Earlier this week, the Environmental Protection Agency and the Chesapeake Bay Foundation celebrated a federal appeals court decision to uphold the legality of the CBF's multi-state cleanup effort. Kara Lofton reports on the ruling's effect on Virginia.
For years since the Clean Water Act was passed in 1972, the Chesapeake Bay failed to meet the standards necessary for it to be removed from the National Impaired Waters List. So in 2010, the Environmental Protection Agency created the Chesapeake Clean Water Blueprint, which was designed to be a joint federal-state effort to reduce nitrogen, phosphorus, and sediment pollution in the bay by 20 to 25% by the year 2025. All six bay states, including Virginia and the District of Columbia, ratified the blueprint and produced their own plans for cleanup. But shortly after the blueprint was established, the American Farm Bureau Federation and several other groups sued the EPA for overstepping the boundaries established for the agency by the Clean Water Act. The Chesapeake Bay Foundation joined the EPA as a defendant. This week, a federal appeals court ruled in favor of the EPA, which means that cleanup efforts will continue in all six bay states and the District of Columbia. Virginia is currently on track to meet 2017 progress reduction goals. This is in large part due to the Commonwealth's extensive subsidy programs available to help farmers fence their cattle away from streams and tributaries. An elated Chesapeake Bay Foundation president, William Baker, spoke to the press on Monday via a phone conference.
Bottom line, this is a great day for clean water. And it's a great day for all 17 million people who live in the Chesapeake Bay watershed who have demonstrated over and over that clean water should be a right, not a luxury that we have to fight for.
The Farm Bureau has 90 days to file an appeal with the U.S. Supreme Court. For WMRA News, I'm Kara Lofton.
Well, let's continue with the environment. This week, Kara Lofton takes a second look at the Clean Air Act. Previously, she reported on the Act's effect on our water. For this story, a look at the Act's impact on our air.
When Dominion Power converted its oldest coal-fired power plant in Bremo Bluff, Virginia, to natural gas, here's what happened. The greenhouse gas emissions from the plant, including carbon, nitrogen oxide, sulfur dioxide, mercury, and promethium, all plummeted. The station was converted as part of a process to obtain an air permit for a new station in Wise County called Virginia City Hybrid Energy Center.
And the reason for that was we did not want the construction of Virginia City to have a net negative impact on air quality in Virginia. So by switching Bremo to natural gas, there was actually a net improvement in air quality in Virginia when we built Virginia City.
That was Dan Genist, a media spokesperson for the company. He said they offered to make the switch. The conversion cost the company $53.4 million and was probably not something they would have done if they hadn't been seeking an air permit from the Environmental Protection Agency to open the Virginia City plant. Air permits are required for major sources of air pollution, for instance, coal-fired power plants that are either newly constructed, such as the Virginia City plant, or make any major modifications, such as the Bremo plant. Additionally, the plants are required to install best available control technology, which controls and limits the emission of specific pollutants into the atmosphere. The effect of these regulations reach into almost every aspect of Americans' lives and include less polluted water, cleaner air for breathing, and increased visibility in national and state parks. Janice Nolan is the Assistant Vice President of National Policy for the American Lung Association. Every year, the association produces a report called State of the Air, which analyzes the amount of air pollution Americans are breathing in locations across the country. She credits the Clean Air Act with reducing the types of pollution that have adverse effects on Americans' health.
We have reduced pollution since 1970. The emissions EPA has been targeting by about almost 70%, 68% since 1970. But just since we've been doing our report, we can see significant improvement in lots of places from that information, the number of unhealthy days that we had when we first started doing the report. First report came out in 2000 and looked at 1996 to 1998 data to today. And you can see places that have improved significantly in that much time with many, many fewer days of unhealthy air.
Nolan says fewer days of unhealthy air means days with less ozone, also called smog, concentration. According to the American Lung Association's website, ozone, which is a gas molecule composed of three oxygen atoms, aggressively attacks lung tissue by reacting chemically with it. Ozone is created from a mixture of nitrogen oxides, hydrocarbons, and carbon monoxide, which mostly comes from coal-fired power plants and motor vehicle tailpipes. The effects of both long and short-term exposure can include asthma, lung infections, lung cancer, and even an increased risk of heart disease. In the valley, increased ozone levels also greatly affect visibility in Shenandoah National Park. Jalynn Cummings is the park's air and water quality program manager. She and other park employees run an air quality monitoring station at Big Meadows. She said since major amendments were made to the Clean Air Act in 1990 that targets sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxide emissions, there has been a steady improvement in park visibility, which is vital for tourism. For her, the real point is that
a big part of the picture is that everything is connected. When you're talking about air, you're talking about water, you're talking about soils, you're talking about ecology. It's all connected. Our air environment affects every other environment that we use and that we play in.
Things are definitely improving in Virginia. The American Lung Association website now lists the Harrisonburg, Waynesboro, Stanton area as one of the 13 cleanest places in the country for both ozone air pollution and short-term particle pollution. But across the country, 44% of the nation still lives in areas where it is too dirty to breathe easy. For WMRA News, I'm Carol Lofton.
Now, from earthly matters to the outer reaches of the solar system, nearly 10 years ago, NASA launched the New Horizons mission to Pluto. And on Tuesday, the spacecraft will reach its closest approach to the dwarf planet before passing by and continuing on to other icy formations far beyond what we have explored before. Carol Lofton talked with two University of Virginia scientists involved with the mission.
When New Horizons was launched in January of 2006, we still didn't know much about Pluto, the mysterious demoted dwarf planet, except that it was a relatively small icy body with an extraordinarily large moon.
New Horizons is going to fly past Pluto and just get a very quick look of what Pluto and its moons look like.
But even that short look will reveal a wealth of information, according to astronomer Ann Verbisker, one of the two UVA professors involved with the mission. Verbisker has been working with two different teams for the mission.
I started working with the KBO search team, which is a team that's tasked with finding the next target for New Horizons to reach after it flies by Pluto.
She said there are two options for where New Horizons will go next. Both are large, icy satellites. The final pick won't be announced until August.
After that, I got involved in the hazard assessment as well of whether flying by Pluto was going to be a safe thing for the spacecraft to do, making sure that there weren't any undiscovered small satellites that could be creating dusty rings that would present a problem for a spacecraft flying through them at 14 kilometers per second. At those kinds of speeds, even a speck, just a few millimeters across, could destroy the whole spacecraft.
So far, almost everything about the mission has gone smoothly. On July 14th, next Tuesday, after more than 9.5 years and 3 billion miles, the spacecraft will reach its closest point to the dwarf planet. Already, new discoveries about the planet are being made daily, such as heart, whale, and donut-shaped surface features suggesting, quote, deposits of frost, perhaps including frozen methane, nitrogen, and/or carbon monoxide, according to the mission's website, which also cautions it is still too early to tell for sure what the shapes represent. These sorts of discoveries are incredibly exciting for UVA professor Alan Howard, who studies the surfaces of planets.
I've been looking at how icy substances on the surface volatilize, or what's called sublimation or evaporation, into the atmosphere or into space, and then sometimes they get redeposited elsewhere where it's somewhat colder. And these create specific kinds of landforms on the surface, particular kinds of morphology on the surface that is diagnostic of the process.
Figuring out the morphology of a planet or satellite helps scientists understand its history and properties. For people such as Howard and Verbisker, studying Pluto is particularly alluring.
This is a region of the solar system that's completely unexplored. The furthest thing we've looked at up close has been the planet Neptune, and that was in 1989. And beyond Neptune, we really have not seen what anything looks like. There are thousands of objects out there beyond the orbit of Neptune. Pluto just happens to be one of the biggest. But we have no idea what these things look like, and we're going to find that out in just less than a week now.
Verbisker and Howard will join a multitude of other scientists at the Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Laboratory to be on hand for Tuesday's flyby. Analysis of the data coming in from the spacecraft will take years and will inform a potential future mission to set a satellite into orbit around the dwarf planet. But in the meantime, the world waits for Pluto to reveal her secrets. For WMRA News, I'm Kara Lofton.
WMRA learned last week that one of our stories from December had been recognized by the Virginia Association of Broadcasters. It was Andrew Jenner's story of the Pipeline Air Force. And he got the view from the air and Dominion's view from the ground. Once more, here's the story that has received an award for Outstanding Feature Report.
1,000 temperature, okay. 10 Celsius, dew point.
The air's a little rough, but the view is magnificent from a few thousand feet above the Shenandoah Valley. Michael Godfrey steers his tiny plane, an M7 Mall, west across Augusta County, through Jennings Gap and up over Shenandoah Mountain, following a line on his GPS that traces the proposed route of the Atlantic Coast Pipeline. A consortium led by Dominion, one of the country's largest energy companies, is proposing the 550-mile pipeline to transport natural gas from West Virginia to Virginia and North Carolina. Frank Mack is communications manager for Dominion Transmission, a subsidiary that would build the pipeline.
There's a huge need for additional natural gas infrastructure. It's going to help companies like Duke Energy and Dominion Virginia Power with meeting new air emission regulations because they're going to be replacing a lot of their coal plants with natural gas.
In and around the valley, this would be a 42-inch line. That's big, bigger even than the controversial Keystone XL pipeline. And its potential impacts on things like property values and the environment have gotten a lot of people very worked up.
I care about the fact that it's coming through my community and that it will be impacting private property and lifetime investments of the people that live there.
Rick Webb is a retired environmental scientist from the University of Virginia who lives in Highland County, a few miles from the proposed route. He's also coordinator of the Dominion Pipeline Monitoring Coalition, made up of a dozen organizations opposed to the project.
I also care about what it's going to do to the ecosystems in the area, and in particular in the national forest. It's a real intrusion into lands that we've set aside to protect and maintain for our children and their children and so forth.
In October, Dominion filed its first documents with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, the agency with ultimate oversight of the pipeline. Dominion hopes to start building it in 2016 and start using it by the end of 2018.
We're looking to make the best route with the least impact to the environment, the cultural and historical resources.
Here's the problem. People like Webb say that whatever this least impact is, it'll still be too much for this special place.
The route that they've chosen through the National Forest and through some of our wild landscape has been about as bad as you could conceive. The pipeline cuts right through the areas that will be the last refuge of the brook trout, of a number of mountain salamanders and other species, bats, birds, etc. We're talking about a very poor choice for a place to put a pipeline, some of the best of what remains and some of the best of what will remain in a changing world.
The two sides simply disagree on what's possible. With careful planning, Dominion says, the pipeline can coexist with these mountain ecosystems.
We've met with technical staffs from both the Monongahela and the George Washington National Forest multiple times. They've made us aware of certain areas that they would really want us to avoid. For example, in the George Washington National Forest, there's the cow knob salamander. So they made us aware of where that salamander generally lives. So those are the kind of things that we're going to try to avoid.
But to Webb, that's trying to have cake and eat it too.
They cannot bring a pipeline through the central Allegheny Highlands without significant damage to the environment.
If the Pipeline Monitoring Coalition fails at its main goal of blocking the project altogether, they'll do everything they can to make sure it's built according to the precise letter of every applicable law. They point to a recent Dominion project in West Virginia as an example of why this is a concern. Between October 2012 and March 2013, state regulators documented at least 16 violations of water quality laws on 9 different streams during the construction of a small pipeline called the G-150 in the state's northern panhandle. Last October, Dominion signed a draft consent order requiring it to fix all the problems and pay a $55,000 fine. Max says that sort of thing is the exception, not the rule.
Dominion works hard to comply with all environmental rules and regulations, and in this instance, we did not meet our own expectations. We agree with the administrative consent order from the West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection, and we are working with the state to resolve all the issues and will implement all requirements of that consent order to ensure it doesn't happen again on future projects.
If the Atlantic Coast Pipeline is approved, he adds, it'll be subject to oversight from dozens of local, state, and federal agencies. That's little comfort, though, to Webb and others who don't have confidence in those regulatory agencies either. Which brings us back to Michael Godfrey and his airplane.
I've never seen that before. Let's check it out. We'll check it out.
Godfrey is one of four pilots that have mustered to form the Pipeline Air Force, the aerial branch of the Pipeline Monitoring Coalition.
The idea is to establish an unprecedented level of observation and surveillance for the construction and maintenance of this pipeline if it occurs. The prospective contractors who build this pipeline for Dominion need to understand that they are going to be held to the letter of the law.
In the meantime, they're also lining up the legal team to help compel enforcement of those laws, if it ever comes to that. And so, the Air Force and the rest of the Pipeline Monitoring Coalition aren't just taking on Dominion, widely regarded as the most powerful economic and political entity in Virginia. They're also going up against Virginia itself, and they're ready to take the fight to the skies.
It is a David and Goliath kind of idea. Some may consider it quixotic, but you have to do what you can in behalf of your way of life and your community.
What's your position, please, sir?
For WMRA News, I'm Andrew Jenner.
1 mile upwind, we'll be departing to the southeast.
Support for WMRA's News and Information Fund, which makes our award-winning coverage possible, comes from Bibb and Dolly Frazier, Eugene Stoltzfus, Janet Trentner, Rory and Jamie Kutaya, Joy Loving, Jim and Pam Huggins, an anonymous donor, and by a grant from a donor-advised fund of Harrisonburg and Rockingham County. You too can contribute to in-depth coverage of issues, events, and people in our community. Find out more about the News and Information Fund at WMRA.org. where you'll also find all of our stories from the newsroom. Be sure to like us on Facebook at WMRA Public Radio to get a heads up on our coverage. And you can follow me on Twitter at WMRA Bob. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director and morning edition host. I'll see you in the morning.